Blog Talk Radio.
How about that? We have a theme song. Is that great? Welcome to DSMA Live Rents, a discussion on parenting, diabetes, and sometimes how they intersect. This is Bennett.
And this is Lorraine.
And we're your hosts. Rents is a program of the Diabetes Community Advocacy Foundation, also known as DCAF, whose mission is to connect, support, empower, and educate people affected by diabetes.
So today we are airing live at 1 p.m. on Monday, which is a new time for us. We're trying something new and see how it goes. We think we'll be a little more peppy at this time of day. We shall see. Today we're going to talk about a New York Times article recently published addressing schools and whether they are meeting the needs of children with diabetes. There was a lot of discussion with varying opinions on Facebook, Twitter, and 2Diabetes. I think Bennett and I probably have strong opinions as well. We'll dig into that a little deeper. And if we have time, we'll talk a little bit about Dexcom G5. I've seen a lot of conversation about people excited about the new technology and some very hesitant about making the switch from G4 to G5, the issue being to upgrade or not to upgrade. If we have time, we'll talk about that and touch upon a gap issue that has been mentioned out there. And at the end of our show, after we get through those conversations, we're each going to share a little bit that we have. It might be diabetes related, it might not be, but just a little tidbit that we think you might be interested in. So our new format, we're changing things up. We have a new time. We've got a new intro at the beginning. We're going to try and see if we can have our conversation in under an hour. We're just trying to mix things up right now, but we want to know what you think. We want your feedback. We want to know what you like to listen to, what maybe bores you and we should steer away from, and anything else you want to share with us. You can find us on Twitter at DiabetesSOCMED. You can find Bennett at Badshoe, myself at Kalkali. Contact any one of us there on Twitter. You can go to diabetescaf.org and comment on the blog. Find us on Facebook, Diabetes Social Media Advocacy. We post there our updates, what's going on with our shows, whether it's in Rents or DSMA Live, the original, our In Vivo show. Find us there, comment there. We're going to keep our eyes out there and have interactive conversations with anyone who's interested. So any one of those four outlets, please reach out, tell us what you think. We want to take your thoughts into consideration for future shows. All right.
Absolutely.
So,
I'm a little concerned that I'm supposed to be peppy, though.
Well, I know I will be more peppy. 9 o'clock for me is tough.
Well, I totally get that, and I think that since most of our listeners listen as a replay when we record, it doesn't matter. So I'm up for attempting to be peppy. Preppy? One of those.
With your eyes odd and collared shirt turned up. That'll be preppy as opposed to peppy.
Right.
So our first topic is this New York Times article, and in preparation for the show, I reread it. I saw it a couple of weeks ago. I was somewhat enthralled with it, and as I'm reading it again, I'm just so impressed at the author. Her name is Catherine St. Louis. Just the accuracy with which she has reported. There's so many things that I read online about diabetes, and I kind of cringe because things are just said not 100% accurately, and I kind of say, ugh, you know, we're just perpetuating misinformation out there, regardless of how good the intentions are. But I'm rereading this article, and I'm like, yeah, Catherine, you did such a great job. She thoroughly researched the issues. She articulated what diabetes, type 1 diabetes is, the differences between type 2. And most importantly, she was very well-versed on the rights that students with diabetes have. And her article, I think the spirit of her article was to educate people. And I just think she did a fabulous job. My son, Caleb, he was diagnosed at the age of 3. He was in preschool at the time, only a few hours a week, but still he was in a school setting. So since he's been diagnosed, he's been in a school environment under other people's care. He's now approaching the age of 13. He's in his second year of middle school, and we've gone through some serious ups and some serious downs when it comes to negotiating his safety and care at school. It's a topic I know that I'm particularly passionate about, and I agree that there are a lot of people out there who really don't understand what their rights are, and I'm all for getting the word out. And it's Diabetes Awareness Month, and there's lots to be aware of, but I think if I had to pick one thing, it would be this. It would be knowing your rights as a parent of a student with diabetes, educating your child, and advocating for them. So I love this article. I love this topic, and I'm looking forward to talking about it more.
Yeah, I think it's outstanding, too. My kudos as well to the author and Catherine St. Louis. Just fantastic. I think the saint is because this is a saintly article. I'm sure she gets that bad joke her entire life, so my apologies. And I think that for me is far more about safe than rights. People just seem to automatically get, you know, their back up against the wall when you talk about rights, which is just ridiculous. But be that as it may, the real issue is the kids are safe at school. And the environment that kids are in school now, I'm afraid, my kids were in elementary school, 10 years ago. Well, no, not that many years ago, but a few years ago. And I think that if you go back a generation to what the elementary school experience was like when we may have been in it, it was a completely different world. There was much less of a concern about some of the things that upset school administrators and make school administrators nervous now. So when I was in school, nobody was worried about anything that was sharp, and there was blood every now and then, and nobody really worried about it. And I think that the awareness of the need to be safe around blood-borne issues has increased. In some cases, I think it is possibly not handled in an even and logical way by schools, and school budgets are very, very tight, and anything that a school sees as an additional cost burden is something that the school administration really tends to react strongly against. So I think the environment's changed, and when people say, oh, well, when I was in school, there wasn't a need to talk about diabetes safety or diabetes rights, I think that that's sort of, happy days is over, and we're now living in a different environment. In the most cases, that's a good thing. I think that, moving on is a good thing, but an awareness of the risk of blood is an important thing, but a phobia of it isn't a good thing. So I probably said too much.
No, I think we saw some of that kind of conversation on the tube diabetes discussion. And two diabetes, these are people who are living with diabetes in some capacity. And I actually posted this article to share it because I thought it was worthy to share, an interesting article. Some of the response was, it was varied. It was very varied. And I think I was surprised by that varied response because of the community that we're dealing with, because we're dealing with people with diabetes. There was, yes, I've experienced this. There was, really, isn't this just the extreme? This isn't really the norm. We're talking about a microcosm of what happens and just kind of exploiting that, right? There was, hey, I grew up with diabetes, and nobody helped me, so what's the big deal? I was surprised by those opinions in that community. I'm not surprised by those kind of views by people who don't live with it and don't understand it. But then when I sat back and thought about it, particularly people who grew up with it, as you say, like when we were in grade school a generation ago, I think you're right about this awareness. Bloodborne pathogen was definitely a term I became familiar with when a new nurse came on staff at Caleb's elementary school and was questioning it. It was not a defensive type thing. It was, that's a concern that I need to know. I know I need to be aware of. Is it really a risk? So she's someone I actually have become very good friends with. Caleb is no longer under her care, but she was very rational and said, this is a concern. Let's talk about it. Is it really a risk? Whereas maybe that term was never used, 20, 30 years ago. But I also think there wasn't as great an incidence of type 1 diabetes. There wasn't the care for type 1 diabetes, I think, was very different than what we see today. The requirements in terms of standards of A1Cs, I think, is much more strict than it was 10 years ago, and again 20 years ago, and so on and so forth. So, today you have kids with CGMs and insulin pumps, and I know Caleb was on injections for 3 months maybe, and we went from injections to an insulin pump and immediately saw how much work an insulin pump is. Things, you can react more quickly with an insulin pump, but you also need to react more quickly with an insulin pump. So if years ago kids were going to school, and we have a family friend whose child grew up with diabetes on injections, and there was no check and sugar during the day. There was, here, take a shot in the morning, go to school, and if you look a little funny, they'll maybe give you some juice or something. But otherwise, there really wasn't a lot of maintenance. There wasn't checking periodically. There weren't Dexcom alerts or other CGM alerts going off. There wasn't giving insulin for every carb that was eaten. So the care standards have changed. The environment, as you describe, has changed. It's a more intense environment, and it's out there more than it once was. So things have changed.
Yeah, I think that's true. And if you're listening to this show, the links that are on the Blog Talk Radio description page for this, there's a link to the New York Times article. There's also a link to the conversation at Diabetes Hands Foundation's 2 Diabetes Forum. So if you'd like to engage in either one of those, please do. So I think that some of the things that have changed, and if you look at a discussion and someone that's maybe, in their 30s or older talking about their elementary school experience, it's very likely to have happened prior to DCCT, the Diabetes Complication and Control Trials, or whatever it stands for, of the mid-90s that brought about the emphasis on tight control. So I think that's very much what you're speaking to. And so I think that's a foundational change in how type 1 diabetes is treated. And I think in that same time frame, you're having school administrators have a heightened awareness of things that could be transmitted by blood, hepatitis, HIV, et cetera. And there's a lot of fear and concern around those. And so you have a kid now who may not have been under tight control 20 years ago, is practicing tight control in school. They're checking their blood more often. School administrators start getting concerned about sharps, and instead of focusing on the universal safe practices for sharps, they just sort of have this, oh, it's a sharp, I'm scared of that, I don't want that in my school, and they just sort of tend to make things up instead of looking at what the experts have said. So what are the experts saying, and who are the experts? Well, if you look at how to help a student with diabetes succeed, it's a publication that was created by NIH and CDC, pretty much experts with input from school administrators and school nursing organizations and physician organizations, large coalition of people I didn't put into it, and it talks about, well, it's important for kids in school to manage their diabetes so that they can be effective in school and to do it with a minimum of interruption to the school process. If someone is self-sufficient, maybe that's less of an issue than if they're younger and they need support. But the goal really is the kids in school to learn, and how can the parents and the school work together to help the child succeed. So the great cases are where, like you mentioned, the parents and the school professionals ultimately become friends from working for a common end, and there isn't stress. And people go, well, you know, in that situation, you don't need to worry. Well, maybe that's the best time to put things in writing, because maybe that great nurse gets a promotion because she's a great nurse, and the new person comes in and maybe he's a little bit less experienced with type 1, and it doesn't act from the same strength that she did. So, you know, put things in writing. That's just a smart practice. It's a more intensive control process. If things are going great, document it. Everybody's going to be willing to say, this is the best way to help this child succeed, and every child is going to be different. Some are going to need help. Some aren't going to need help. And the gamut in between. So I think that maybe speaks a little bit to why people are saying, hey, you know, I didn't have these problems. You know, you're overreacting. Now, overreacting is part of the problem, but anyway, I've babbled.
Yeah, no, I think what you're saying are all great points. I love that resource that you referred to, How to Help the Student with Diabetes Succeed. That, in much of what I researched to help me understand how to make Caleb successful in a school environment, because for me at least, he's diagnosed, I don't really know how this works. And he was in the hospital for a couple of days, and then we went back to school. Now, he was in preschool, and like I said, it was only a few hours a week, so that was kind of an easy way to go back. But once he started, you know, he got into kindergarten, and that was a whole new element, a whole new environment, and new things to consider. And each year, as he advanced to the next grade, things change academically. The environment changes. His academic and testing environment changes, and he changes. What he's able to do himself changes. So when I was looking at various resources to help me understand, okay, I'm in a totally new world. No one I know personally that I can touch has any experience with this. I haven't seen it anywhere else. I found that guide, How to Help Students with Diabetes Succeed, was a very balanced reference. It was easy to read. It's very comprehensive, but yet organized very well, easy to read, and balanced. It didn't say, here are your rights, and you should fight for this, and, you know, go get them and make sure you get everything that you ever wanted. It was, this is what's reasonable, and this is what is fair to expect. And maybe it's not exactly everything that you're picturing, but this is what is reasonable to expect. And it breaks it down by teacher, nurse, principal, and even gym teacher, bus driver, and what are reasonable accommodations to expect from each of those people. And that doesn't mean that that's a script for what works for everybody, because as you said, everybody's different. And I refer to the fact, you know, Caleb started in school environment at age 3. He's almost 13. Things have changed dramatically in those 10 years in terms of his care and his role in it. And where it was once highly supervised, it is not really supervised at all at this point, but there are still accommodations that are reasonable in order for him to have a fair, appropriate education, which is his right, as is every other student's right to have. So I love that reference. There are other resources as well. And I think as you started the show by saying it's not necessarily about rights, and that can be an intimidating word and put people on the defensive, I agree. It's about keeping the child safe at school and making sure that they're treated fairly. And to me, it was also about not only keeping Caleb safe, but to not restrict his access to education. And the old way of doing things, in my mind, it's the old way of doing things, is there a diabetes care action to be taken? Go to the nurse. Another one, go to the nurse. Oh, you got to do that? Go to the nurse. To me, that just didn't work. He was missing too much, and it was unnecessary. And we were able to negotiate and come up with a reasonable balance between when does it make sense to go to the nurse for care, and when is it okay for him to have his care in the classroom where he is so that he doesn't have to leave and miss the math lesson or even whatever it is. It doesn't even have to be a lesson, just the experience, whatever educational experience is going on. So for us, in that case,
right, and they would say, oh, well, you know, during recess or during lunch, the student can go to the nurse because there's no academic process happening then. But, you know, socialization, in my mind,
right,
is a critical part of school. And to me, is every bit as important as the academics. So just so that everybody knows, we'll put the link to how to help students with diabetes succeed in the show description on Blog Talk Radio. But, you know, I'd kind of like to rewind a little bit. And, you know, you look at that article and it talks about discrimination. So I'd like to talk for just a second about what that means. And disability. So, you know, often when we think of disability, we think of severe physical handicaps. And what we're taught, and so often with diabetes, we want to say, well, diabetes isn't going to limit the child. The child can do whatever they want. So it's difficult for people at times to say, well, you can do anything you want, but you have a disability, but you're limited. So the legal definition of a disability is that there's some physical process that doesn't quite work right. And we all know that in type 1 diabetes, the hormone system that produces insulin doesn't work. So the kid with type 1 diabetes has a disability that, if it isn't accommodated, prevents them from normal life functions. So when in the context of talking about schools, I talk about disability, that's what I'm talking about. The kid's pancreas is broke. And there has to be a process to mimic that pancreas. It isn't, you know, so disabilities vary. And it's going to vary from child to child. But let's keep in mind that when we say disability, that's a legit thing. And it is in the context of the legal definition of disability as it impacts schools that the word disability is being used.
And I'm just going to interject here, because this might help frame this a little bit for people, because I agree. When you throw out the word disability, that kind of doesn't float well with people because of exactly what you said. You know, diabetes doesn't have to limit me. But in this context, a peanut allergy is a disability. Caleb has a peanut allergy, and it's something that I often overlook in terms of advocating for his safety, because it's so much more straightforward than caring for his diabetes. There's so much more that needs to be considered when caring for his diabetes, but it's the same thing. It's considered a disability, having a food allergy, and there need to be accommodations for that. They're much simpler, but it's the same thing. And I'll let you continue, but when I hear disability, I just view it from the standpoint of it's a definition that helps cover my son and his safety at school, so that not only is he safe, but he's also having an emotionally balanced experience equal to that of his peers as much as possible.
Right, and I think it's important when we talk about a disability and a discrimination that this isn't a contest. You know, so it's not the peanut allergy kids versus the kids with diabetes, or if it's we're talking about discrimination, it's not a contest of some forms of discrimination are really horrible and others are less so. So to say that a child couldn't go to school, for instance, because of their race, which has happened in this country in the past, is horrible. And in some cases, school districts will say that child can't have a public education because they have diabetes. So that's an extreme case of diabetes discrimination. It is diabetes discrimination. I'm not going to try to draw a contest with ethnic discrimination. They're completely different things. They both matter. We should be concerned about all. You know, it's tough to use words, particularly discrimination, that often becomes a code word for an ethnic issue that our country still needs to deal with. But and that's part of the burden, I think, of having these conversations. So I always suggest to people, well, don't go in talking about rights and don't go in talking about discrimination because they're charged words. Go in and talk about education because that's what everybody believes in. And to your point, if we want to keep the child in the classroom as much as is humanly possible, and we want that child to be safe there. And I think that those are where you start the conversation. And back to keeping the student safe, it coaches people on how to have those conversations. And I think that there are tremendous resources at the American Diabetes Association. The New York Times article quotes Crystal Jackson, who, in my opinion, is a saint. Mm-hmm. Just a wonderful woman who has pioneered much of the work in this space. She's a mom of a child that had diabetes, had issues at school, had the school system say, can't, and the school system didn't respond to reasonable, which was unfortunate. And that actually became the basis for her tremendous work with ADA and others. And I'm proud to be one of her trained advanced Safe at School advocates. So what we want to teach people is be calm about this. It's really, really difficult to say to someone who was just diagnosed or had a child just diagnosed with type 1 diabetes and is reentering the school system, now's a good time for you to be calm because, let's face it, it takes a year or two for the parents to believe that they're going to get through this.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a good time to be calm. It's a good time to appreciate reasonable accommodations, and the goal is safe and educated.
Right. So,
and I always suggest that people fall back to those. Go ahead.
The article talks about some of the examples of where children are not being treated fairly, and it could be that a school says, I'm sorry, we can't take your child. It could be, I'm sorry, your child can't go to this school because there isn't a nurse at this school, so you need to go to this school over there that is going to uproot your child, you're going to be with totally different kids, not convenient for you, but they have to go there because that's where the school nurse is. That's not legal.
Or you're not allowed to
do that.
Play sports or participate in extracurricular activities, or the parents have to go on field trips, and all of these things.
Yes, and I think
are
those
forms of illegal discrimination.
Right, and what you just said, I think, are probably the more prevalent things, and the things that people are less aware of that they can say, well, no, you can't exclude my child. If it is a school-sponsored event, whether that's any kind of extracurricular activity, there should be someone trained in care for your child to ensure that child's safety, and that's including field trips. Parents cannot be required to attend a field trip. That might be your preference. And that's something that when Caleb was in elementary school was actually in his 504 plan, was I'd like to go. I'd like to be given first option to go on a field trip if chaperones are allowed, or even if they're not, I want to be there. And that was included in his 504 plan. It was also included that sometimes field trips, they ask the parents to drive themselves. Well, I had included that I would be allowed to ride the bus with him. And the school was very open to that because that was one less thing they had to worry about. So that was something that we worked out that was agreeable to everybody, and there was nothing really to discuss. That might not be convenient for other people, and I think people aren't always aware that the school really does need to provide for that child's care in the school, on the field trip, in an after-school event, in a before-school event, whatever it is. Whatever is offered to any student, your child needs to be included in all children need to be included. They cannot be excluded because of diabetes or peanut allergy or whatever the reason may be. There's various other things outside of the scope of those things. They have to be included.
So I just want to do a little bit of term definition. You mentioned the 504 plan. And
yep.
Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of some year or another that I don't remember off the top of my head is one of the laws that basically says the federal government mandates that if you take federal money to provide an education, you must follow this set of rules. And you don't have to meet all of them, and there's a number of different laws that create a legal structure that requires accommodations. Now, you might not always agree with what a reasonable accommodation is, but some kind of accommodation is required. So Section 504 is one of them. Section 504 has what people call Section 504 plans, and they outline the appropriate accommodations for that child and their specific abilities and disabilities. And where they, you know, so with diabetes, where they stand with their self-management. One of the cases that has come up has been, or a number of the cases that have come up have been a child, an older child, and high school kids' ability to carry glucose monitoring equipment and syringes and insulin to administer insulin as needed. And some schools have said we have a no sharps policy, no needles. You can't bring them here. And, you know, a reasonable accommodation is that, well, to attend school, the child has to maintain their blood sugar, and the goal is to do it in to have tight control, and to do that they need to monitor their blood sugar and act accordingly. They need to monitor. So a prohibition on monitoring is not reasonable unless there is reason to believe that it won't be done safely. So it's not just the safety of the child with diabetes, but the child's peers. And if someone is not yet mature enough to responsibly manage their own sharps, then they shouldn't manage their own sharps. So that's one of the rules. You know, I think we've been going on for 30 minutes, but let's just go on for a few more. And maybe I can speak from personal experience, and I won't go into too much detail, but we had a good relationship for a while, and it soured very radically. And we had school administrators saying, well, you can't believe anything he says. And I go, well, good, don't believe anything I say. Believe what keeping the student safe with diabetes has to say.
Right.
And sometimes it's just a clash. And, you know, there's times when I'm not the easiest person to get along with, and we were dealing with people who had a reputation for not being easy to get along with. And, you know, he made a big point of, look, well, your kid checked their blood sugar, and when they closed the drawer, they smudged blood on it, and, you know, I make him preserve that so that I would see the blood. And I was like, yeah, you know, they were putting the sharp in the jar in the drawer where you told them they had to put it instead of leaving it where they could get at it. Coincidentally, the exact same type of sharps were being used in the science classroom to poke fingers and put a test of blood on a piece of glass to put in a microscope to look at. And there was no, they threw them right in the trash. There was no universal precautions for blood when it was part of a curriculum issue, but it was an issue for the kid with diabetes. So that was just weird. The really important takeaway for me is, do your very best to be reasonable. School nurses are the very heart and soul of where you should be working. I mean, most of them are fabulously wonderful people. Most of them are thrilled to work with a parent. and most of them didn't get their nursing degree with a high amount of diabetes education. So bringing them resources, letting them consider those resources, and then working with them to make a reasonable accommodation that fits in their workflow and your child's workflow and you as a parent's workflow is really ideal. And, you know, to loop back to the point of, well, people are saying they didn't have these problems when they were a kid, God bless them. I think most of the kids with diabetes right now are in schools and they're not having issues and they have supportive school nurses and supportive school administrations and supportive parents. But a breakdown in any one of those legs of support for a student is going to make that student's experience difficult. And that can include the parent. So, you know, I guess that's my two cents. And do we want to move on to another topic or is there more you want to say?
That well, fair. Yeah, no, I think thankfully, I've seen and I've heard a lot of great success stories and relationships built between parent and school nurse or school secretary or teacher or whomever it is that's helping the student with diabetes. I hear a lot of those stories. But to the point of someone saying, hey, but this is really the exception, not the norm, I hear a lot of stories where people are not having that fantastic experience. And we, after having six pretty smooth years, three of which were dreamy, things turned for us as well. And I turned to the American Diabetes Association Safe at School program. We had Crystal on one of our past episodes. She reviewed the Safe at School program, and they very much want to encourage parents to educate and advocate and work collaboratively with school personnel. And I totally agree that walking into a team expecting that we're all going to work together and let's just try to understand each other, please try to understand me and my needs and my son's needs, and I want to understand you and your background and how you've handled this in the past or if you've handled it in the past, let's bridge those two things. To go in saying, this is what I want, but also know what's non-negotiable and what is negotiable, because there are so many ways. If this is not a cookie cutter situation, there are so many different ways to handle caring for a child with diabetes and ensuring their safety at school. And I've seen many of them just with my son, as I said, through the years. So there can be limitations staff-wise, but there's also creative ways to work around those limitations. And it is certainly best to have open lines of communication, to work cooperatively, and it can be an emotional situation. It can easily be an emotional situation, and it can be easy to become defensive. And if it does get to that, just try to resist that and try very hard to work with the people that your child's going to be dealing with on a daily basis. And I cannot speak enough to the American Diabetes Association, the Safe at School program, the resources they have available. They helped us tremendously, guided us in every way possible that we needed. And we ultimately had a successful outcome to what our situation was. And Catherine, the author of the article that started this whole discussion, her article includes resources, whether it's referring the reader to ADA, the Safe at School program, or the Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights, who actually will take these cases of complaints, should there be complaints. We had one, and we worked with the Office of Civil Rights, and they helped us to get to the resolution that we got to, and it can be daunting, but I think should you need to get to that level, you'll find that it is a fair process and you'll hopefully reach a desired outcome. Hopefully that's not your experience, but in terms of takeaways, I just want people to know what is fair and what is reasonable, and if they're coming into a situation where they're being asked to ask for to care for their child at school, that's not right. That's not the case. If they're being told their child can't go on a field trip, no, that's not right. That's not fair. And I think this article refers to it, and it's something that is a concern of mine. I hear the stories about all the great success, what wonderful experience people have. I hear the stories. I hear the two ends, right? The people who are having difficulties, and then there's this group in between of students, of people who are probably just kind of getting through the day, and they may not. They may just be accepting things that are presented to them without understanding that maybe that's not right. And that's the audience I think I want to be able to reach as much as possible is, hey, maybe you don't realize the situation you're in, or maybe you don't think this is unusual. You think this is just the way it's supposed to be. And I think that's probably, you know, the biggest population of people is they just don't realize that this isn't the way it's supposed to be. So, like I said, that's my point of awareness for this month. What I would like to get out there as much as possible is to educate people on what is fair. And this also, you know, we're talking about students and kids in school and maybe focusing on elementary students, but this extends, you know, into college and even the workforce. I don't have experience in those areas yet, but, you know, the same holds true in terms of knowing what is fair and reasonable.
Right. And, you know, on that happy note, I think that we should let people know, and you will have seen it because this will be on the links before you get here, but we'll have links to that conversation with Crystal Jackson that we had a while ago, as well as a link to the Safe at School and a link to Helping the Students Succeed in our Blog Talk Radio show description.
Absolutely. So moving on, we can talk real quickly about G5 versus G4 and whether to upgrade or not to upgrade. I can speak to our experience. Caleb has been a Dexcom user since he was in first grade. He's now in seventh grade. So we've been through many iterations. We started G5 very soon after it came out. So I guess, what is that, about a month now. And we have not had one issue at all. I think originally he was in the habit of always having his phone with him. He's an iPhone user. I'm an iPhone user. So G5 allows you to use an app on your iPhone that replaces the receiver that you're used to carrying around. But he was used to carrying it around. So he would take it with him. And probably it's only been probably maybe a week and a half where he's starting to forget it and leave it at home because I hear it saying out of range when he's at school and it's left at home. And I've heard perhaps more from people who are wondering if they should make the change, that they're worried about losing Wi-Fi connectivity or just some kind of connection. And that has just not been my experience at all. Caleb has pretty much stayed in range the entire time. We've had issues where even with the regular share receiver, which allowed his receiver to communicate with his phone and push information to the cloud, and then I can see his blood sugar from where I am from the application I have on my phone, there would be times every once in a while where I'd say, hey, dude, I have no data, and he'd have to reset something to establish his connection with his share receiver. I'm actually finding that less to be the case. We're having those kinds of disruptions less. So there's conversations out there about people being concerned. I'm worried about doing this and moving ahead. And that's fine. Like, G4 is still awesome. And there's, I think, value to having that extra receiver, just a dedicated receiver. And that kind of works in some cases. Like I said, Caleb was carrying it around with him for the first couple of weeks. And now he's like gotten used to, or, you know, felt safe with just his phone, and we don't have this data issue. I would point people to a discussion that was had on our sister show, the DSMA Live show. Scott Hanselman called in after Charisse and George had a discussion about George's G5 and referring to a post that Scott made. And he makes a really good point about how the new how G5 and the transmitter, how it communicates and how it's different than the G4 system. And I'm not going to repeat what he says. He has all these pictures, this great little like flowchart type diagrams, and it's a different way of communicating. And as he describes it, there can be periods where you just lose a connection and a little bit of information. And I see his point. And I think he's coming from a technical background, and he's saying, you know what, this shouldn't be. You can do this differently. Like, why aren't you doing this differently? But I also think it created a response from the community where people said, oh, my gosh, there's going to be gaps in information, and I'm not going to have what I used to have. And, I refer you to the DSMA Live discussion because Scott calls in and he explains exactly what he meant, and I think he brings clarity to where people may have misinterpreted his intentions. But I guess I really don't understand. I mean, I can understand from a personal preference why you wouldn't upgrade to G5. You like to have the receiver. I think that's a personal preference. But I'm just going to say my one experience, Caleb's one experience, is we're not having any connectivity issues. So that's just
so, you know, I think there's a fascinating parallel here with schools. So some people are thriving with G5 and the innovation, and other people are maybe later adopters are comfortable with their G4. The parallel is the school might be comfortable with what they were doing in the past, and technology is moving forward. And in one area that is going to cause tension in schools is connected diabetes processes, where diabetes information is going to a phone. Schools might not like phones. Mm-hmm. That phone is a phone and a medical device. So that's an area to have a conversation. And, you know, what's reasonable for you, your child at your school nurse, is something that needs to be talked about. I think that what's significant is if you look back at the progression of, you know, some schools had kids with diabetes, and the clinics, and when we first started, our clinic did this, they put our children on NPH to avoid school issues, to avoid the need of giving a bolus dose at lunchtime, because NPH had that incredibly imperfect midday peak. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of somewhere kind of around lunch, and then the kid wouldn't need insulin. Well, as we get to tighter control models and people using strictly fast-acting insulin and pumps, they're getting better outcomes, mm-hmm. less variability, better A1Cs. It takes a little bit more intervention. It takes a little bit more capacity. It takes giving insulin during school hours. And that's a change. And all those changes are being made to accommodate, hopefully, fewer complication in a child's life and a long and healthy life. So that's the goal, and it's not just in-school safety, and it's not just being a techie that wants to adopt everything right now versus somebody that's content to be a later adopter. It is the diabetes is unique. Each child's diabetes is different. Each family's situation is different. And the accommodation needs to fit into that lifestyle, the goals mm-hmm. that the family has for diabetes, and that may or may not include technology. I think that one of the wonderful things about G5 is you hear anecdotally the stories where the school nurse is on the share list and is seeing the glucose information as needed in relatively real time. And that, I think, is an advancement. It's one that maybe we as a society, we as a diabetes community haven't figured the best way to implement yet, but God bless the nurses and the families and the schools that are the pioneers in figuring out how to do that. So I'm a big fan of G5. I think we will adopt it through our next cycle of insurance processes. We weren't eligible for an upgrade at a reasonable price. So,
just to clarify, what you're describing in terms of the nurse following along, that's available with the G4 share system. That the G4 share, the receiver still exists. It is a share receiver, though, that communicates with the person with diabetes iPhone, and allows that person to push that information out. So Caleb's been using that since March of this year. His school nurse can follow along on her phone. The only difference that G5 that we've really felt, I should say, is that he can just leave the receiver at home and solely use his phone. But everything else, like, I see absolutely no difference from where I am, because the G5 change didn't impact what I see. It's the same as what I saw with the G4 share upgrade. And then there's also another difference in terms of the app that the user, the person with diabetes, sees. The graphing is different. You can input information on it. You can input your blood sugar as a number as opposed to going up and down arrows starting at 120. You can input information. You could do this with the other receiver, but it's easier with the phone. Insulin dosing and exercise and all that kind of stuff. I just want to make that point of clarification. But what I would love to do is invite our listeners to give us feedback about what they think about G4, what they think about G5. Are they interested in upgrading, but they're a little worried because of what they've seen? Or, you know, help me understand, maybe I'm totally missing something and there are gaps out there and there are experiences where people have had difficulties and, you know, therefore the concerns are valid. I just can speak to what our experience has been in the last month, and it's been smooth sailing for us. Maybe we're just lucky. And I think Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that people's experience is going to vary. Scott clearly brought up some things that he thought were valid issues. How you live with a device is going to vary, and we encourage people to do what's best for them and define what's best for them. At least I guess I should speak for me, but I'm pretty sure I'm speaking for you too, so what the heck.
You are, yeah, absolutely. We are like-minded in many ways, Bennett. That's why I enjoy doing this show with you. And hopefully people enjoy listening to us.
Yeah, we want to do with the new show is just close with one thing that's sort of outside of diabetes.
That's right.
And... you know, so do you have one you want to share?
You know, mine has nothing to do with diabetes, as you said. Maybe we're sharing something for diabetes. Mine has nothing to do with diabetes. It is an app, a to-do list app that I incorporated, I adopted about a month ago, and I've tried many to-do apps and failed miserably. I go back to pen and paper and my notepads, and I can say that I have not used a to-do physical piece of paper list in at least a month. And I'm so excited because this app is just keeping me focused and organized, and I won't say life-altering, but it's definitely made a difference in how I get things done. And the app is called Todoist. Todoist, and I have it on my phone, and I have it on my laptop, and they talk to each other, and what's magical is that, or what makes it different from other apps, is that I can assign dates, and if I didn't get to it on the date that I wanted to do it, I can move it ahead and not feeling like I failed something. It kind of shifts it into the future and then doesn't show up on my urgent list of things that and the other thing it allows me to do is make subcategories of things. So I have a to-do list of just the things that I need to get done. I have a list of things I want to talk to my son who's at boarding school about, who rarely talks to me because he doesn't have any time. So I like just plop it there, and I don't lose it on a sheet of paper in my house. It's just right there, and when I do get a chance to talk to him, I just go to that section. I've got a Christmas shopping section. And so all the thoughts that come into my head, I can enter them on my phone. They're organized, they're tidy, and it's just really kept me focused, and I love it, and I highly recommend it. It's called Todoist, Todoist.
So I will mention an app, and it doesn't have anything to do with type 1 diabetes. Well, a little bit to do with how I deal with my type 2 continuum, and that is I use an app called Strava, and it is an exercise app. And I will admit that I was afraid to use it initially because I heard about it from Adam Brown, who was possibly the most physically fit person I've ever met. You know, could beat me at any physical challenge. And it was like, hey, join these challenges. And I was like, I can't beat you in anything. Why would I want to do that? But really what it is it's just a way of seeing peers be active. And I know that peers are really important in a lot of aspects of life. And for me, knowing that peers are out being active is a way for me to join in and say, yeah, me too. And that's what I use the app for. So there's a half a dozen, maybe a dozen people who I track on this app from around the country, actually around the world. And I see them being active, and I think, you know what, I need to go be active too. And then when I'm active, I get a little attaboy, just like a Facebook like, but without the politics. And it's a wonderful little way for me to stay engaged with staying active. So that's my app or comment of outside the rent sphere for the show.
You know, sticker charts have been effective for little ones, and that's what I feel like this kind of stuff is. You know, it's nice to have a little reward of something, and it really does make a difference, I think.
Yeah, you know, people work for love and money, and nobody gets enough of either one of them. So tools that give you a little bit of, even an infinitesimally small amount of loving for doing the right thing are a good thing.
All right. So we got through our new format. We didn't necessarily shrink the amount of time that we spoke, but we did cover a very intense article. It was a meaty conversation, that New York Times article, and I know we both have a lot to say on it. So probably not representative of other topics and how passionate we might be about other topics. And this is our first go-round, so I really enjoyed this. What do you think, Bennett?
I did too. It was great. And I would encourage people to go to 2Diabetes Conversation and join us there, or join us on Facebook or Twitter or wherever you see fit. We appreciate feedback.
Yes. And as Bennett said, we're going to post links. What I'm going to do is I'm going to create a blog post at diabetescaf.org, and it'll recap this show and include the various links that we mentioned, and we will post it on Twitter and on Facebook, and go there, go to those places, whatever works for you, and talk to us. Let us know. We want to engage with you. We want to make this show meaningful for you guys. We had fun, but it's not just about us chatting with each other. We want to interact with you guys as well. We thank you for listening to us. And we hope you'll be back next time, and we look forward to your ideas and suggestions.